to welcome beloved listeners to another week of the Little Wireless program. Shortly, we will mingle with Tingle. I suppose we will discuss, among other things, the issue of same-sex marriage and the idea of divorce, that is, divorcing Australians from their citizenship, and perhaps there are moves afoot to divorce us from the incumbent Prime Minister, Laura, shortly. Yiannis Varoufakis is the man of the moment in Greece. Well, some say his moment has passed and he's on the way out, that he's being sidelined and is about to resign. Yiannis will tell us what he thinks is going on personally. He's going to come out of a meeting in Athens and rejoin the program. And finally, we're going to spend some time with the unsung heroes of the Shackleton expedition. I just heard, as I came on air, that Joan Koerner had died. You know, the ALP's got a tradition, perhaps a proud tradition, of turning to women at times of political crisis to clean up messes, and Carmen Lawrence comes to mind, Anna Bligh, Christine Keneally, and I suppose I would add with a tad of reluctance, Julia Gillard, but nobody did it better, nobody, than Joan Koerner. I haven't got time now, sadly, to sing her praises, but I have to say that as well as being honest and earthy and brave and decent, she was funny. She was one of the funniest people I've ever known in public life. Greatly to be missed, greatly to be missed. Also funny in public life is Laura Tingle. Laura, sad about Joan?
I think it's very sad. She was very funny, and some of the listeners might remember when she went on The Late Show. Do you remember The Late Show, Philip?
Absolutely. Yes, and when she appeared as a rock and roll singer.
Joan Jett, yes.
Yeah, she was terrific.
And sang spectacularly flat. I mean, wonderfully flat. But she also endeared herself to unlikely people like PJ Keating, because they together had to save the State Bank of Victoria. And I think Keating was, my recollection is Keating was incredibly surprised by how great she was to deal with in what were very dark days in the early 1990s when they were trying to save a state government bank from collapse.
She could have actually been of great help to Yiannis Varoufakis if only they'd had a chance to meet. Okay, let's look at goings on, and heavens above, the goings are very on at the moment, aren't they? It's the last time we spoke, we were discussing the budget. Now let's can we look first at this the notion of dissenting voices divorcing themselves within cabinet over the notion of citizens being divorced from citizenship?
It's been a very bizarre time in Canberra, Philip, in the last week, with this cabinet meeting last week about citizenship and the stripping of citizenship from people who are terrorists, as the Prime Minister says. The feeling around Parliament as it resumed for this week's sittings was even more extraordinary, because after Peter Hatcher went into great detail on Saturday about who had said what to whom in this cabinet meeting, everybody was blaming everybody else. And it had become a proxy for the leadership debate, as everything does in Canberra these days. And people were blaming Malcolm Turnbull, Malcolm Turnbull's supporters were blaming everybody up to the Prime Minister's office for leaking what Malcolm Turnbull was alleged to have said to make Malcolm Turnbull look soft on terrorism. The backbench was writing letters in support of the Prime Minister and against
signing petitions, for heaven's sake. I've never seen that before. It's hilarious.
The great irony to me is that my very cynical take on this is that, okay, there are all sorts of national security issues that are having to be considered, but a lot of people have pointed out, for example, that less than 2 weeks after the federal budget, when the Prime Minister is still saying that this is the most crucial thing that has to happen in the Parliament, we have to get the budget through, last week the attention completely turned to national security. Some would note at the same time as the Lindt Cafe coronial inquiry started, some people would say a week before the lead up to the latest news poll, which comes out tomorrow. That's the very cynical view of it. But without a doubt, I think whatever those contextual things are, the government believes that national security is an issue where it's got an advantage over Labor and is constantly trying to wedge Labor on this.
But now it's wedging itself because here's this very strange group. Julie Bishop, Malcolm Turnbull, Barnaby Joyce, George Brandis, Christopher Pyne, even Kevin Andrews are regarded as being dissidents.
Yes. Absolutely, absolutely. And I think that there is a lot of confusion, I think, around about this because there are these two separate issues. One of them is about stripping Australian citizenship from people who've got dual citizenship. And that's got a whole range of very complicated issues around it anyway. But that was something that was agreed to by Federal Cabinet last week and supported by the party room. We still haven't seen the legislation. And just getting back to that wedging point, the Prime Minister's out there again today saying, what I want to know is what's Labor's position on this, because they're soft on terrorism and all that sort of implicit message. But you know, I think it's reasonable of Labor to say, well, we'd like to see the legislation before we get into the details of it, because there are a lot of complex legal arguments involved there. But the really contentious idea is this one that that the immigration minister would be able to revoke the citizenship of an Australian citizen who was believed to be involved in or supporting terrorism. And this has all sorts of hairs on it. But apart from that, the whole way the government is explaining it is morphing as we speak. Scott Morrison came out today and said, oh, look, people misunderstand what this is about. This is just purely about trying to stop people. It's not about stripping them of citizenship. It's just removing, possibly temporarily, some of the rights of citizenship. And to be specific, he was saying it's the right to come back to Australia if you've been overseas. Now, this is not what the Prime Minister was saying when this was first announced officially last week. It's been on the drawing board for some months, but when he announced that this discussion paper raising this possibility was going to come out, and it's certainly not the way he and his immigration minister, Peter Dutton, have been explaining it for the last week.
And, of course, Julie Bishop is quoted as being deeply pissed because she didn't see any paperwork on this, and it was shoved in at the end of a cabinet meeting almost as an afterthought.
Yep.
So the group saw themselves as being conned.
Mm.
And the extraordinary thing, I mean, to me, the biggest part of the story is that the next day's Daily Telegraph published an absolutely confident piece saying that it had all gone swimmingly. How could they have got that information?
One really doesn't know, Philip. Who could possibly know, you know, that the Daily Telegraph, that seems to have such an intimate tete-a-tete relationship with the Prime Minister in his office, how could they have come to that position? And I thought one of the most wonderful bits of the entire reported exchanges in the Cabinet brawl was Malcolm Turnbull apparently saying to the Prime Minister at one stage, well, one thing I've got to say is I hope we don't see this turn up in the Daily Telegraph tomorrow. And Tony Abbott replying to him, oh, no, that definitely won't happen, which unfortunately it did on page 5 the next day. And this is made only more ironic by the fact that all these people are going around saying, oh, it's terrible and outrageous that this brawl has leaked, but apparently it's okay for it to have leaked that the Prime Minister had this really excellent, cunning plan on stripping all these baddies of their rights.
And as you pointed out earlier, the backbenchers have now been rallied and up to 40 of them have signed their petition. That's and they want the PM to be even more aggressive.
They do, but it's interesting to note, Philip, that this was a petition or a letter which must have started and I think was being circulated around the chamber during question time on Thursday. This is the day after the initial story appeared and the momentum about about what had happened started to really trickle out. When you actually read the letter, all it's really saying is, you know, dear Prime Minister, please be very tough on baddies. It's not, I don't think, explicitly backing the individual measures that are a matter of contention.
Okay, now, to what extent is this another leadership battle?
Well, I think it's not a leadership battle. I mean, it's certainly a proxy for the leadership issue, but I think realistically it's been, it is very damaging, unfortunately, for Malcolm Turnbull, because it's not clear to me that he was the leaker. He has been damaged by this within the coalition, because you do see this real feralness about being very tough on terror. And so it's effectively being used by Abbott backers to say, see, we told you he was weak on these national security issues. So it's been damaging for Malcolm Turnbull. It's therefore obviously been good for the Prime Minister internally. But I think overall it's basically a debacle, because it once again shows the government of the day is not in control of things, is a shambles, and is deeply divided. And whatever voters think about national security, they don't like division.
Well, it's not a proxy battle when it comes to Shorten, because he's now got one of the biggest wedges in recent history to deal with.
You're talking about national security?
Yes, I am.
Yes. Oh, well, absolutely. But, I mean, I think this is a very deeply disturbing thing, Philip, because one of the things about all of this is that the coalition is desperately trying to wedge Labor. He keeps thinking if it just goes one step further on national security, at some point Labor will either have to say, look, no, this is outrageous, and then it will be accused of being soft on terror, or Labor will start to split internally. Now, as we've discussed, all that's happened is that the coalition has split because it's been so outrageous. But I think it's still really, it's very depressing and disturbing for the community that the result of Labor's position, which is we're not going to get wedged, is that it basically is flagging all this legislation through with barely a murmur. I mean, they're talking about being worried about this legislation, but at no point have they said, for example, on either the dual citizenship issue or the idea that you might actually eventually strip Australian citizens of their citizenship, that they would be against this in principle, or that they would have deep, deep reservations about it or anything like that. They've talked about the technicalities of it, but essentially they don't want to be out of step with the government on national security at all. They want their focus to be on the economic debate.
Meanwhile, of course, Shorten is wedging the Prime Minister over matters of matrimony. We had a listener write in, Laura, saying, why don't we make moves to remove marriage altogether? Think of another way of giving equality to all under the state without the state of matrimony. But boy, after the Irish referendum, and we did a very good program on that the other day, if I say so myself, it makes life very difficult for a Catholic Prime Minister.
It does make life difficult for a Catholic Prime Minister. It's interesting. I think Bill Shorten can find an argument to say, well, look, after Ireland, of course, we should just be, here is a point in time and we should just be acting on it. There is an opportunity there for him. He is, without a doubt, I think, trying to probably wedge Tony Abbott on this, just, you know, doing a reverse wedgie, if you like, on Tony Abbott. I don't know whether it's ultimately been all that successful, because by doing what he did, Tony Abbott sort of has come back and said, look, this should be an issue for everybody and not one side, and has played that argument up reasonably successfully to make Bill Shorten look like he's being opportunistic. The net result, though, is we're at this point where there's not quite enough votes at this point to get the bill through the parliament, and unless and Abbott has effectively used this argument that that Shorten is being opportunistic to keep the dissenters within his own ranks sort of in line. So For people who actually want to get an outcome, it's not entirely satisfactory. But
it's funny, Laura. Hmm? You and I have used the term wedge about a dozen times in the last few minutes. I think it's time to replace the emu on our coat of arms with a wedge-tailed eagle.
The emu with the wedge-tailed eagle. Yes, I see where you're going there, Philip.
Well, it's a wonderful symbol of a very potent political weapon. Okay, before we say goodbye, on your page 5 special in the AFR, there's a small article about the suggestions by Minister Andrew Robb, Trade and Investment Minister Robb, to open up aviation in the north of Australia to foreign competition. And while we're staying with birds, this is ruffling a few feathers in Cabinet as well.
It is. This sort of has emerged more or less from nowhere. We know that the government wants to, and particularly Andrew Robb, is very keen on a pro-Northern Australian development policy, and we're likely to see a white paper on that in the next couple of weeks. But there was never this idea that foreign airlines could do hops above the topic of Capricorn, say Brisbane, Darwin, on the way to somewhere else, sort of has emerged from nowhere. But as always, the Nationals aren't very happy about this because, apart from anything else, Virgin and Qantas are already very aggressively lobbying about it in the background, saying, look, we cross-subsidise all sorts of regional airline routes. If you start introducing foreign competition effectively on some of the internal domestic routes, we won't be able to keep cross-subsidising. So Warren Truss is leading a fairly large pushback against Andrew Robb on this, and he's being backed by Scott Morrison, who keeps turning up in all these debates, who's a former tourism official, of course, and I'm told that Joe Hockey has also swung across to be fairly aggressively against the argument as well.
Got to go. Laura, great to mingle with Tingle. Laura, political editor with the Australian Financial Review, and the phone's ringing. I think it's Yanis from Athens. I've always regarded John Oliver with considerable respect. I think he's one of the more cogent satirists in America, and his new television show is terrific. It's called, of all things, Last Week Tonight. But I fell out of love with him when he attacked Yanis Varoufakis, who, of course, is a friend of the program and I regard as a friend of mine. He made the most extraordinary attack on Yanis, complaining about his clothing. And something similar happened on this very program when our financial expert, Sir Judith Das, said some things that weren't very nice about the Greek finance minister. And so Yanis is entitled to the right of reply, and I'm delighted to offer it to him. And let us remind you, dear listener, this is a crunch time as negotiations continue between the government and the IMF and the EU, and the first of the June repayments are due by Friday, etc., etc. So, Yanis, welcome back to Late Night Live. I'm very pleased that you found a bit of time. Fire away about Das first.
Well, let me first say that it's always an oasis for me to, as a dedicated party, to come back to LNL. Okay, now, I'm sure that Satyajit Das didn't mean to fib about me, that he was also a victim of the propaganda. So let me, Philip, start with the most trivial. He mentioned that in a photo shoot for pre-match, my wife and I were drinking Australian Chardonnay. It was not. It was a very nice, beautiful wine from the island of Santorini. And I have to say this because otherwise the good people of Santorini would be very cross with me. The second point, if I may, that really hurt, the second point. He told the story of how Michel Sapin, who is my French colleague, the French finance minister, came to me and said that he doesn't read very much, but he reads philosophy instead. It's not what he said, Philip. What happened was this. I gave an interview to a philosophy journal, a major French philosophy journal. It was actually a discussion with one of my heroes, philosophical heroes, with Jon Elster, the Norwegian philosopher. And that was a great spread in that philosophy magazine. And what he said to me was that he doesn't read very much, but he read me in the philosophy magazine. Okay, let's go to the third one. He does repeated the rumor that Prime Minister Tsipras has sidelined me during the negotiations. It's not true. Let me just tell you what has been happening. For months now, the other side, let's say, the Troika, has been trying to push a wedge between the Prime Minister and me, predicting my resignation, in order to effect it, if I may say. And then inventing the sidelined rumor to explain the predictive failure of those stories. And lastly, Philip, there was an oxymoron in what Das said. He began by saying, quite correctly, that Greece in 2012 defaulted within the euro, and that was the largest ever sovereign debt default in the world, which is true. And then he continued to argue that it would be farcical for me to expect a default within the eurozone. So, there you are. I had my right to reply, and I'm thanking you for it.
Well, you are my most distinguished poddy. And what about the John Oliver attack on your clothing? Do you wish to have a go at that as well?
No, I don't. I'm not going to defend my clothing. All I'm going to say, Philip, is that I wear the same kind of clothing I always did, even when I was appearing, you know, I was visiting you in Altimo, when I was teaching at Sydney University. I wasn't going to change what I wear just because I became a minister. And the notion that you can only be serious and respectable if you wear a tie is rather absurd, given that, as we all know, the best ties and suits are worn by the mafiosi in New York, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. No, Yanis, I just thought it was... I was quite actually more shocked by Oliver than I was by Das, actually, because... Anyway, let's not dwell on all this. When you were made finance minister, you said your greatest fear was that you might turn into a politician. Have you been able to avoid that? And if so, is part of the reason, as you tweeted and quoted Franklin Roosevelt, they are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred?
Partly, but only partly. Yes, I have managed to maintain the posture and behavior of somebody who's, you know, has always been a political animal, but who desisted becoming a politician, if you know what I mean. The reason, however, why there has been a character assassination in progress, beginning from Brussels, but also here in Athens, against me, is not so much because I, you know, call a spade, but it's primarily, Philip, because I'm the finance minister of an indebted European country who refuses to do as he's told. He refuses to simply sign on the dotted line and accept more debt in exchange for policies that create more misery and reduce the incomes from which these extra debts will have to be repaid. It's not the done thing in Europe, it clearly, and I'm not being tolerated for that purpose, not because
of
what I'm
when
wearing.
When you used to come on the program as our expert on matters Greek, you were making these same arguments, so they can't really have come as a surprise to anybody. However, there's another very strong rumour at the moment, and that is that your party, forget your relationship with your Prime Minister, that your party is now fracturing down the middle because of, the conflicting attitudes on whether or not you should leave the EU.
No, that is quite untrue. It's quite untrue. There is a lot of concern in the party. There's a lot of concern in the government. There's a lot of concern amongst the Greek people concerning what? Concerning one thing, the nature, the texture, the essence of the agreement that we are going to be striking with our creditors and the Europeans and the IMF and bringing to the Greek parliament. Nobody has seen it yet. We haven't even seen it yet because it's a work in progress. So my colleagues in Parliament are particularly worried about what will they do when they see it, because it won't be an easy one. It won't be all roses. There will be thorns in it as well. So they are worried, can they sell it to themselves first? And then can they sell it to their electorate? That is a concern that we all have. But I can assure you, Philip, that if the agreement that we strike does not pass certain basic criteria of humanism, to put it bluntly. We are not going to be tabling it with our parliamentary party or with the parliament. But there is a great deal of consternation. But let me just finish this answer by saying that there is a great deal more discord amongst the other side, between the institutions, between the European Commission and the IMF, within the European Commission, within Germany, within the other side, to put more generally. Even within the Christian Democratic Party in Germany, I believe that Chancellor Merkel has a greater problem convincing her own MPs than my Prime Minister has convincing ours.
Janusz, there was a voice from America a couple of days ago urging Europe to settle with you. Is that having an influence on negotiations?
We will never know until we see evidence of it. The evidence is sort of hazy at the moment. There is a clear urgency on the part of several very important leaders in Europe to complete an agreement. And for the benefit of the Gladys and the Podis, let me just say that what this agreement requires now is something equivalent to what happened in 1946 in Germany when Secretary Barnes delivered the infamous speech of hope. That speech, you will remember, marked the end of the attempt to turn Germany into a pastoral state, the end of deindustrialization, and the beginning of hope that the Germans, as long as they worked hard, they could become a normal nation, a normal state again. This is what we need now. This is what we are negotiating about. It's not, you know, the VAT rate, the sales tax rate, the pension system in particular. These are all details. What we want is a speech of hope for Greece. And I believe that there are several important leaders, I would also count Angela Merkel amongst them, that want this. But it's finding a consensus amongst the very multidimensional, let me say, cabal of creditors that we are facing during these negotiations.
It is remarkable, I think, that for the last 4 months you've been managing not only to pay salaries and pensions, but also extract from the fabric of the public sector up to 14% of GDP to meet repayments of the IMF and other creditors, because you don't have access to the money markets.
Indeed, not only do we not have access to the money markets, but also the loan agreement that we inherited as the new government stipulated that there would have to be repayments from us to the creditors, to the IMF primarily during this period, but also that there would be disbursements of monies from the IMF to us so as to be able to refinance this debt. Now, these disbursements have ceased. They have not happened for the last 8 months. But the repayments from us to them, primarily to the IMF, have been continuing. So to those who say that the Greek state cannot live within its means, my answer is, of course it can. It has been, not only has it been living within its means, but we have been meeting repayments that were scheduled to have been met by new disbursements. So in a sense, we're being asphyxiated as part of a bargaining tactic to have us succumb to a logic that has failed over the last 5 years. And this is why the negotiation is ongoing.
I'm talking Greek Finance Minister Yanis Varoufakis and the gathering crisis that has to be resolved pretty soon. Now, there are two crucial areas. I know that most concern you, labour reforms and pensions. Wages have been reduced by 35%. Pensions have been cut between 20 and 60%. The IMF wants you to do even more?
Indeed. And this is why the negotiation hasn't settled yet, because we're refusing to continue along this path. As I said, the Greek state now lives within its means. We can pay pensions and salaries. To cut them even further will jeopardize the possibility of growing the economy and therefore increasing the tax take so as to be able to get out of the debt deflationary cycle. I believe that there isn't anyone who would disagree with us, even within the institutions, even with the IMF, that there is no logic to this. And yet the political circumstances as such that you can't have, it's very hard to elicit from the troika of lenders, from our creditors, a common view that it is about time that they turn the page. It's very hard. Look, Philip, it's very hard for you and I to admit that we've been mistaken. Imagine how hard it is for all these convoluted institutions to agree that for the last 5 years they've been pursuing the wrong policies in Greece.
Yiannis, okay, let's accept the argument that that's a massive cut in pensions. What about lifting the retirement age? Now, this is a pretty contentious issue. The IMF is pressing Athens to lift retirement age to 67. Brussels, slightly more charitable, number of 65. Athens wants it to be 62 years. Surely the retirement age in Greece is too low.
That is quite right, and we have admitted that, and we are prepared to criticize it. What we're saying is that it has to be done smoothly, gradually. And our main concern, Philip, is that we have many early retirements. We have people in their late 50s and people who are 60 and below the 62 threshold are retiring. They are being forced by private sector companies, by banks, for instance. They're being pushed out off their books, off their payroll, onto the pension system, and is detrimental to the pension system's sustainability. And we want to change that. But you have to understand that, unlike in Australia, for instance, where, if you are 60, 61, and you become unemployable because you're in the metal sector or, in some mining town and the mine has shut down, and it's very hard for you to retrain as a hairdresser or an IT person, right? that you have Social Security to fall back on. And this, you get helped by the Social Security system until you are of a pension age. But in Greece, we don't have a functioning social security system. So for decades now, politicians and the state, naturally, in the absence of social security, would try to unload these unemployable older workers onto the pension system. And we have to change that.
One of the things Das mentioned was that he believed you'd prefer to default. That's not the case, is it? Although you have said previously that Greece should never have joined the Eurozone and it was impossible to manage recessions as you can with an independent currency.
That's quite right. I said that, and I also said in 2010 that Greece should have defaulted then. And I still believe we should have defaulted in 2010, because you have to remember that in 2010, the Greek state didn't owe €1 to the German taxpayers or the Portuguese taxpayers. It was all debt to private banks who were, hopelessly irresponsible the way they had lent to the Greek state. As you know, for every irresponsible borrower, there is an irresponsible lender. And when these loans pop and they can't be serviced anymore, both sides ought to suffer. So, but that's bygone history. Now what we have is all these loans were transferred from the books of the banks quite cunningly and cynically onto the shoulders of European taxpayers. A huge haircut now. It would be a haircut that will make the Portuguese, the Slovak, the German taxpayers suffer. And we're not proposing that. But what we are proposing is a smart swap of bits of one part of the debt with bits of the other part of the debt in order to smoothen out the debt repayment schedule, in order to make possible for Greece to return to markets and start borrowing from private investors, and to manage the debt in a way that, you don't need to be a radical lefty to see that. Any financier, any proper financier would agree with us that this is what you need to do. This is how the private sector does it all the time. So we're asking for just some serious, clever financial engineering that reduces the debt burden of the next 10 years, smoothens out the debt repayment schedule, and allows Greece, in conjunction with a proper investment plan, to be able to grow sufficiently in order to make our debt sustainable. This would be good for our creditors too.
Now, you're among friends, Yiannis, so you can confess, and it will remain between us. You don't have a secret printing press churning out drachmas in the basement, ready for a plan B?
No, we don't. We don't. This is something I've been saying for years now. Those who are advocating that we return to the drachma should know that we don't have the drachma. And we don't even have the printing presses to get the drachma. So we would have to actually order Matis, you know, a new currency from overseas. And that's just a complete nightmare scenario. This is why I'm not contemplating.
I remember us talking about the growing problems of Greece before your transformation into a finance minister, and you were worrying about the parties lurking about the place like Golden Dawn. What would they like to happen? What would be to their political advantage?
Our failure. The other day, last week, Philip, I was in Parliament, and I had to answer a question from a member of the Nazi Golden Dawn Party, a certain guy who has actually hit a Communist Party member of Parliament live on television. He actually struck her. He punched her. So this is the kind of person we're talking about. And he was looking at me, ironically, while asking the question, and he was saying that people like you, you know, in Australian terms, it would be something like you, Chardonnay socialists, are sipping your wine on verandas and in front of swimming pools, whereas we are on the street fighting against austerity and against the memorandum and so on. And this is why we're in prison. And I stood up when my turn came to rebuff him. And I looked at him and I said, Mr. Kassidiaris, you're not in prison because you've been fighting against austerity. You are in prison because you are criminals. And you can see that they're just eagerly awaiting for our failure, because they know very well that if we fail, the political system is not going to return power the failed center left or center right, but it will tilt towards this kind of misanthropy.
Yanis, youth unemployment is 50%. What does that do to a society?
Well, it creates massive migration and hopelessness. It sacrifices a whole generation on the altar of austerity and makes sure that our human capital is depleted for good.
Well, we wish you well. How many hours away is crunch time?
I wish I knew, because last time we almost did not make a payment to the IMF, surreptitiously money was discovered. So this drip-drip Chinese torture, as they say here in Greece, is continuing. I think the ultimate deadline, of course, is the end of June, which is when the current loan agreement ends. And unless it is renewed by means of a proper, serious, rational agreement, the whole thing is going to go pear-shaped.
Let us hope that doesn't. Yanis, thank you for your time. Yanis Varoufakis, Greek finance minister, and a potty. And coming up, the forgotten men who risked their lives to make Ernest Shackleton's Imperial Transantarctic Expedition possible. Our museums and our books and our shared memory are full of heroes. And they often eclipse the roles of less important but equally significant people that made their triumphs possible and sometimes shared in their failures. Thus it was for the members of Shackleton's Mount Hope Party, 10 brave blokes who played a vital yet ultimately futile part in the Imperial Transantarctic Expedition. And Wilson McCorrist is hoping to put the fact that they've been eclipsed to rights with his new book, Shackleton's Heroes, which tells the men's story using previously unpublished extracts from their field diaries. Wilson, qualified physicist, lawyer, entrepreneur, 8 years researching the book, and he joins me in the studio. From what's written in the diaries, it's clear that your blokes were thinking about previous Antarctic exhibitions, and they're often tragic ends, weren't they?
Well, that's right. In those days, the loss of Scott a few years before to these people was often on their mind, and they lived for, you know, I think it was one quote from one of the men, Joyce. He said, why do you do it? And they said, we did it for the Empire. A bit like why people went off for the First World War. which is hard to understand now, but they did it in those days for the empire. And
they often ran into physical reminders, didn't they, of previous expeditions?
Yeah, well, that's right. They, one of the men, Joyce, he'd been twice to Antarctica, so he knew what it was all about. The leader of the Mount Hope Party, McIntosh, had been to one previous one with Shackleton about 8 years before. So that they knew what to expect.
The story you tell is so important, we should spend an hour on it. We don't have an hour. So I'd like you to tell the listener, who were these men and what is the essence of their story?
Well, there were six men, really, that went out to Mount Hope, which is on the edge of the what's called the Beardmore Glacier in Antarctica. And Shackleton had them put down a series of depots for him when he came across the continent, if he'd come, because he couldn't carry enough food across himself. So without these depots over the last 350 miles, he would have died. So uppermost in their mind was for these six men to place the depots for Shackleton, come what may. And the fascinating thing from my point of view was they were completely different men. There was the leader, McIntosh, from a well-to-do British family, an officer in the Merchant Navy. There was Joyce, a crusty petty officer. There was another guy, Wild, who was another petty officer, whose brother was Frank Wild, who was actually with Shackleton.
There were three scientists too, weren't there?
Yeah, that's right. Three of them, one of them was Dick Richards, one Australian out of the six who went to Mount Hope from Long Gully in near Bendigo. And he was a 22-year-old physicist who went there. And I don't know whether he'd ever seen snow before he went. I mean, I doubt whether he did. And there was a padre just been ordained as a minister in England.
Was he there on spiritual service,
well,
on spiritual duties?
I don't think so. Really, Shackleton appointed him for some reason, mainly as a photographer, because Shackleton was very much into keeping records, like he did with Hurley. You know, when the endurance went down, he made Hurley keep some of his plates. So the record was kept of what happened.
Now, the first season of depot laying went pretty well, except all their dogs died.
Well, there were two problems. One, their dogs died, which really was a mistake of the leader, McIntosh, who put them to work straight away. And the dogs loved to work. It was a husky-type dogs, most of them. But they weren't acclimatised, so all but five died. But the second problem was, again, a McIntosh mistake. Normally the ships go down to Antarctica and they can only land there or stop there during January and February because that's the only time in the summer where they can get close enough. And normally they go back to New Zealand or Australia for the winter and then come back again the following January and February. But he decided to moor the ship and leave it there, and a blizzard took it out to sea with all their provisions on board, all but 10 men who were then stranded on in Scott's old hut with virtually only the clothes they stood up in, old sledging rations, in the middle of winter.
I've got to ask you about Hoosh.
Yeah, well, Hoosh is a term they used for, they would mix a beef fat called pemmican, which came in a tin. They would mix it with just water. They would boil the water and they put this a beef fat in, a pemmican, with biscuits and sometimes with some chocolate and mix it up. And that was their hoosh. That was their stew, if you like, and the only hot meal they had during a day. And they lived on it. And the problem was, for these six men, they were out on the barrier for so long, they all started to develop scurvy because they didn't eat any fresh meat. And that was a problem for them, that some succumbed very quickly and had to be carried on the sledge by the other men as they tried to get back to safety. And really that's what the story is all about, is these six men who lay the depots for Shackleton, come what may, but then have to come back to safety. And that's the integral part of the story, how they try to do it, thinking of Scott dying as well, where Scott had died in almost the same place where they were caught in a blizzard for a long time as well.
I should have mentioned, of course, the Aurora.
Well, the Aurora's a bit like the Fran from Mudson days, a very famous ship in those times. Mawson used it on his expedition a bit before, and then it was bought by Shackleton. And it took the men down there, and it was the ship that was in the ice, and they thought it would be okay, or McIntosh thought it would be okay for the winter. And it was taken out to sea, and it took 9 months before it could get back to New Zealand because it just couldn't get away from the ice. And it was the ship that actually returned a year later, a year and a half later, with Shackleton on board to rescue the survivors of the Mount Hope party.
Tell us about the sequence of deaths that start occurring.
Well, I think the events of the Mount Hope party and the deaths in it were the things that made me realise it was far more tragic than most stories that have gone on in Antarctic exploration. Because these six men got to Mount Hope, laid the final depot for Shackleton, and then had to come back, and they'd put a depot at each point of latitude about every 70 miles on the way out for them to pick up and return to the next depot rather than take all food all the way up for themselves. And one of the men right near Mount Hope, the Padre, he collapsed with scurvy, and from then on he couldn't walk, so they carried him on the sledge. And they got to about 70 miles from the safety of their hut, where they knew they could get fresh meat, fresh seal meat, and which would help their scurvy. And they ran into a blizzard, but eventually Spencer Smith died only 20 miles from safety. And so they buried him and pushed on.
They buried him in the ice, didn't they?
Well, they tried to dig a hole in the snow, and by this stage the other five, or certainly three of the other five, had a little bit of fitness left, but not much. But two others were just hopeless.
So did Spencer Smith leave a record of his final days?
He did. And when you're in a museum or an archives room, as it's normally called in Christchurch or Cambridge or wherever, reading these diaries, you know that this man is going to die in 2 days.
You know it. Does he know it?
He doesn't know. He's got no idea at all. And apart from McIntosh, who had come from a well-to-do family in England, he complained about the snow and the cold and the poor conditions. But the other men, there's never a word of complaint in the world.
I just want to stay with Spencer Smith for a minute.
Okay.
Here he is in terrible shape, but he's not contemplating his own death at this time.
No. His last diary entry, it happens to be his sister's birthday. So he writes at the top of the diary page, abbreviate just the first letter of many happy returns of the day to Frederica. And then he says how cold it is, but the next day they hope to get into safety. And I think maybe with a Latin quote to finish, as he often did. And then the next day he doesn't write, and then the following day he dies.
Okay, McIntosh announces that he and Hayward will risk the ice and walk to Cape Evans.
Yeah, I think that aspect of the whole story is the most tragic because his comrades, by then three other men, the Australian Richards, Joyce and Wild, had dragged McIntosh and Hayward, who had both succumbed badly to scurvy. So by the end of it, there were two men on the sledge. Spencer Smith had died, and the other three, with four starving dogs, had finally got them to safety. And the safety, there were two main huts in Antarctica. One of them was just a shed with a veranda, actually. It had come originally from Australia with Scott about 20 years before or 15 years before. But they had another hut about 13 miles away, that's all. And it was quite salubrious. It had insulation and lighting and food. But they couldn't walk there until the middle of winter when the ice was completely frozen. But McIntosh impetuously and took Hayward with him, decided that they could walk when the ice wasn't safe. And the others told them not to go. The others said, no, we think there's a blizzard coming, don't do it. And one of the last diary entries of one of the three survivors is that he could see McIntosh and Hayward walking into the distance, pygmy-like, and they slowly disappeared into the white.
And the others went to look for them after the storm, and they find only tracks
footprints
leading to the edge of the broken
ice. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and then suddenly the tracks stop where the water starts to, where the ice becomes water.
And this leads to one or two possibilities. They'd either fallen through thin ice or they'd been carried out to sea on a floe.
Yeah, and that carried out to sea on a floe is almost unbelievable to imagine it. And the interesting thing with McIntosh is that 6 years before, when he was in Antarctica, he and another man had actually got caught on a floe and almost lost their lives. And he actually wrote his diary in a book called Shackleton's Second Lieutenant from before. His actual words, where he's talking about jumping from floe to floe as it gets taken out to sea. And he said this other man and he knew they were lucky, so they got to safety. And he almost wrote his own death from 6 or 8 years before.
Are the diaries angry, or are they simply reflective of what's going on? Do they blame people?
No, there's an argument between the non-commissioned officer, Joyce, who had a lot of experience in Antarctica, with his boss, McIntosh, that McIntosh made mistakes. And Joyce knew he'd made mistakes. But apart from that, nothing at all. There's never... I heard Richards, who lived till he was about 80 or 90, some of his interviews, he said, we just had a job to do. You know, they got the George Cross for bravery, for saving a life on land, and yeah. He couldn't work out why. He said, well, we were just saving the other guys. We couldn't leave them, could we?
And there's the bitter twist. The rescue party doesn't arrive until January 1917. The Aurora finally lands, and they're shocked to see Shackleton aboard.
Yeah, and Richards, for one, he'd never met Shackleton in his life. And there's almost nothing that they write that they're bitter that they've done all this for no value at all, because Shackleton never came across, and the depots are still there under 50 foot of snow now.
I would have grabbed a harpoon and tossed it at him, there's none of that.
No. Certainly what does come across, and there must have been something about Shackleton that these men were absolutely in love with, you know, would do anything for him, or they did anything for him.
We've just touched on aspects of this extraordinary story. And Wilson, I was telling you before we came on air that years ago David Putnam and I had the grand vision of making a great feature film on the Shackleton expedition, but we couldn't overcome the logistics or find the budget. This story, I think, is even more cinematic but needs a mini-series. I bet you get an offer.
Thank you.
I hope you do anyway. Wilson McCorrist, physicist, lawyer, and author of Shackleton's Men, which is published by Robson Press. It's been a big night for the program. I hope you've enjoyed it. And it's now time for the news on RN. Back tomorrow with Bruce Shapiro.